So just reflecting here for a minute, when I first met you, Carol, I was in graduate school. And one of the things that jumped out at me was you were offering two premises. First was accept nothing I say without trying it out for yourself. The second was actually reject nothing without a deep experience and reflection and testing before you reject it. But that's really core to this epistemology. Before we get started today with Business Second Opinion, I want you to guess what I'm drinking. A Rebel Elixir. Actually, it's turmeric gold milk, which is really, really good. It's made from whole turmeric and ginger. And just so you know, Rebel is not only the sponsor of our podcast here on Business Second Opinion, but they create righteous plant alchemy like this, which means it's good for your body, good for your being, and good for Mother Earth. They go a step further to co-create a future without human trafficking. Rebel donates 2.5% of all net sales to Not For Sale. And through impact sourcing, they help communities to thrive and prevent their vulnerability to trafficking in the first place. Their rallying cry is, "We are Rebel." We're so proud to be associated with them and help tell their story. Please enjoy their great products and find out more at rebel.co to find purchase locations. Business Second Opinion is the podcast that digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. Questions you may not always know you need to be asking, but we believe you should. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. I'm Zach Swartout. And with me, as always, is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big, hard questions with a radically different take. How's it going, Carol?
Great. Thank you.
So when we last left our heroes here, we were showing the differences between these two approaches of the expert versus the imager. We were looking deeply at how the expert, kind of conventional intelligence mindset, or someone who shows up to give us answers, actually neuters innovation, whereas the imager, who works from a place of questioning, actually encourages innovation and believes that intelligence is ubiquitous and varied. As we were wrapping up last time, we promised people a much deeper dive into the other seven aspects of the expert versus the imager and how to know when we're working from either.
So I played with all nine of those epistemological clues that I mentioned last time, and I realized that there are basically four of them rather than nine, and some are subsets of others. And once I could see that through this kind of organizing framework I was looking through, I thought this will make it a lot easier for people to work with. So then in each case, I could see how to contrast the two different ways, the two epistemologies between expert and imager, and so could other people.
So just a reminder on the source of this imager approach. It's an imaging way of understanding. So another way of saying this is it's about seeing a living being as it interacts in real time in a context, evolving itself with the intention of understanding how to work as a living process. So Carol, you actually talked about this before with the dissection of frogs to understand them versus imaging them living in the world to understand their relationships in a greater system.
Yeah, I also realized something else going back over all of this, which is besides the expert epistemology, which we have talked and we'll keep talking about the problems, even before that and more insidious is the authoritarian epistemology. I'm only allowed to know and think about what I'm allowed to think about by some authority outside of me. We see many attempts at this. It's I often call mind control, like think of authoritarian regimes.
Yeah, so that actually helps me to understand why people in authoritarian countries defend leaders who work against people's own best interest, like their own interests. It's like propaganda is all they've been allowed to know, so it limits how they see the world. But we're not going to add that in today, right?
No, I probably shouldn't have brought it up. I just wanted to people to be aware that epistemologies are operating in all cultures and frame and create the boxes and the biases that people end up in. And determining which we and others are in or maybe fostering is a very important to know what we're operating from. Then we can tell if we're going to build the capability for great intelligence and innovation, which we also started with last time, when we hire those consultants. So that's where we started. And 90% of companies and organizations hire for and borrow the practices of the ones that radically cut off those highly desirable ways of working. Now, how's that for a premise?
Yeah, I mean, so short of authoritarian philosophies, there are places inside our country where this is relevant that I actually want to point to for a second, where these kind of authoritarian epistemologies flare up. And it's actually one of the core ways of defining a cult. Unquestioned or unexamined ideas espoused by a single leader. From time to time, I see these show up in consulting practices, and this comes from them being proselytized far and wide without any real critical examination. That was actually one of the questions behind the question we got that led us to this podcast for today, and the one from last time as well. But we should come back to that another time.
Yeah, we're both obviously fascinated by it, so we will. But we're really working on a way to assess any help we're about to buy, whether it's consultant, educator, therapy. I suggested we look at the 4 clues now rather than 9 that are limiting or enhancing the development of intelligence and the capacity for innovation, which is the expert versus what I'm calling the imaging, and I mean by imaging life epistemology. And examine those in terms of how intelligence and innovation happens or not. The imaging life paradigm fosters the growth of intelligence in everyone and innovation among everyone that's in the organization. And that's the Einstein process of imaging life living. I like that. Life living. And we can learn to use it when we want to, but also when we're asking for, paying for, and being sold help. So let's start with why we even need to do this. Why do we need to avoid the expert way of knowing, especially in business, but everywhere? And why is borrowing ideas not acceptable? Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, so 3 come to mind pretty quickly. First, we can't create from our own essence because it's actually someone else's idea. This can lead us to being easily displaced in the market, actually, now that I think about it. And we can't make up an idea about differentiation because it's not nearly as powerful as really being differentiated by who we are, not what we do. We're actually less likely to be us and more likely to be someone else.
Yeah, and a bad version of somebody else. I agree with that. So what was your number 2?
I guess for the second one, we don't connect with customers in an enlivening way. We can't do something distinctive for our existing or potential customers because it's us giving them a modified version of what others are offering. And this leads us to compete on price and efficiencies instead of what really matters.
Yeah, that seems to build on your number 1, where if we can't be us, we also can't figure out how to give them something unique. Number 3?
Yeah, and so third, this results in an inability to create a really compelling business strategy, which is needed to give people something to grow toward and contribute to that they can sink their teeth into. Basically, you can only be a Me Too business rather than lead an industry or lead project categories. So already I have 3 objections, and those were just off the top of my head. So the ability to work from our own ideas, I think, in a lot of ways defines a life. So we can all agree we better get past the expert model into an Einsteinian process and learn to get better at it.
Yeah, you know, those 3 things are a perfect place to start because in the last episode, that was part of what we were talking about also, which was being generic, and that being generic is at the core of expertise and what an expert epistemology is all grounded in. I've got an idea, I hold it, and it's the idea of finding a universal answer or a theory of everything, some call it, which means you really have to, in some ways, dumb it down, banalize it to get to something that you think you understand and you can teach others in a way they can understand. You know, keep it simple, stupid. They want a set of 4 or 5 things to remember that will explain everything and a set of steps. And they want to do that so that the answers are easy. And in order to do that, you got to be generic. You have to collapse the subtlety and the uniqueness. It's like, I remember my grandmother, me cutting off the corner of ham to put it into a pan. And I didn't know why, but it was a generic thing you did everywhere. It's a lot like that here.
Yeah, so the first clue to an expert approach is being generic, as you say. Experts see people are all in 1 of 4 types or some number of types, which we've talked about before on previous podcasts. But you can divide everything up into 1 of 4 quadrants, which seems to hopefully at some point add up to a whole. You can easily tell this in businesses who focus on working to hire Einsteins, right? They pay for top talent, which we've also covered in another podcast. I mean, after all, isn't that easier than making everyone smarter than you?
Well, it's not easier or better for democracy, and certainly not for each individual who's seeking some kind of compelling opportunity with equity built into it, which to me is a foundation of democracy and a fair economic way of life. But in spite of this terrible for democracy and the individuals, if you want a practical reason, it's not even better for the business. What's better is if everyone has a connection to the personal and professional growth infrastructure, understands and values the direction of the business strategy, and is increasingly capable of making a unique contribution. That's when the business does much better. And certainly it's not better if the few have to pull the many, which the top talent ideas. That leaves you needing lots of oversight, lots of direction, i.e. a hierarchy, not to mention that everything in the business from earth to earth needs innovation and needs it more and more often, which means you need everybody doing it, and it calls on everybody getting smarter and smarter over time. So having a few is not the answer. Innovation and intelligence everywhere with everyone is the answer. And you know, my experience, at least in business, is people have a strong desire to have a job that, when done with the project or the task, leaves them smarter, not just with new skills, not with just new knowledge, but actually smarter in the process of inventing and figuring out how to do things, how they can think, how they can discern, so that they can invent the next new content themselves. They want to be originators, innovative.
Okay, so that's a clear clue. If it's sold as a best practice, it's a generic theory of everything, which really is a theory of nothing special. I've seen this before. You borrow the best practice and you can buy the consultant, and they'll be delivering the generic de-innovator diminisher of intelligence for your workforce. If I sound skeptical and a little bit jaded here, it's because I am. More knowledge unexamined and presented as generic is wasted money.
Well, even skeptical, it's a pretty good summary of the downside of generic offerings compared to that which comes from the epistemology that actually fosters the growing of intelligence and the expansion of innovation by using the ableness to image a specific living system at work, like a customer's life, like a market we need to be in, like this specific small business. And by this, I mean one that you shop in that's local in your community.
This actually reminds me, we got a note from Jennifer T. of Western Mass, pointing out that everything we're talking about on assessing help from consultants also fit for finding the right education approach for her child and for her role as an educator at the university where she taught. She was hoping we would comment on that this week.
Well, all right. Why don't we do that with the second of the four clues, and we'll use education as one of the examples. The second arena we need to examine is the goal of the expert versus the imager epistemology. So there's a clue there. The goal of the expert model is to show you what the ideals are you're to achieve. These, again, have to be generic, but they are also recommended for you to use to create plans, measure outcomes. They're often stated in missions, visions, purposes, sometimes just in management by objectives. We not only lose the idea of the specific compared to the generic, but we become very abstract because we no longer can see how it connects to what we're doing. Even when we say that we are a mission-driven company, it may make us feel better, but we don't have the ability to be specific to a place, to peoples who are there, and to the materials, raw materials of life that are there. John Mohawk, I have read everything he's written, everything I can find. He was a professor of history of Native American culture and colonization at one of the New York SUNY systems. He points out that utopian ideals and visions of ideals are the master tool of deconstructing indigenous cultures, because the ideals are always drawn from abstract, do-good, Anglo-Saxon set of ideas projected onto local peoples from the colonizers. And the local people have no say in the grandiose ideas. By definition, it means dismantling their way of living. So, for example, there are longtime stories told of how indigenous children were and still are on reservations, often removed from their homes and put in English schools to stop them following the pagan rituals, speaking the pagan languages. He said the greatest clue to cultural deconstruction in any place was the well-intended utopian ideals from others that are offered as a way of making your life better.
Well, This is massively depressing. I always thought ideals were something to aspire to until we started this episode and you started talking about this with me. Is there something that the imagers might offer us here, Carol, to uplift a bit?
Yes. The imagers, instead they ask, what is this place? What is this work to be done here? What is the voice of this place? What is the voice of the people who are here? What are the life forms that are here, and what story are they telling? So they're asking questions. They're not imposing ideals. And they even ask, how does it work when it works well for all that's connected and all that lives here? It requires being in a very different state of mind, like a present moment imaging of the working of the place and letting go of the imposition we have of what we want on it and we think is best for them. The do-goods we've talked about before. It requires noticing how often we project our own ideas onto others in the name of visions, missions, and purposes. For example, if you learn about tracking, you learn to shut off your human eyes and ears and listen as indigenous people do when they're hunting. It's a proven useful by even the military. The code breakers weren't looking at land, but they were looking at patterns in World War II. The Australian police force quickly discovered that they could learn to track criminals if they could learn to image how the thing was working rather than just try and follow clues. Their answer is, how did they do it? The answer to how did they do it was to go around and around a place or an event, almost like circle it until they could see more and more and more. That's what they tell you. I kept looking. I kept letting go. I kept re-imaging until I could see more. They often describe it when I've asked questions about what they're doing is they're like shutting out physical details and imaging the life of a person, imagine them moving, connecting. They're not looking for evidence in the sense our police forces might now, but they are living and engaging entities that they're watching living. You know, I watched my grandfather do it, but you'll have to connect with our members who are educating and tracking really to be able to improve this nature of imaging the capacity and getting that capacity as a part of how you see the world.
You know, when you mentioned visioning, it made me think of the ideal end states that get brought up so often in strategic planning, which is also often a package that comes from expert consultants, obviously. I remember in a previous episode, which we'll mark in the show notes, where we talked about the problem of future tense reasoning, which keeps our thinking beyond anything we're held accountable for today. But as Mohawk says, that often is probably for the best that people never actually follow through on those things when you're doing this kind of reasoning.
So they get rescued by our future tense thinking. Okay, let's keep going on these four clues. So the goal is achieving ideals, all this. That's what the expertise is about. Well, the reason you do that is ultimately to produce scalability, you know, where it can be everywhere and therefore it then can be replicated. So these are two dead giveaways to the expert way of knowing. In the time of the colonists, it was called Western expansion. In business, it's just about scaling programs, platforms, and pedagogy as fast and far as you can. Again, this goes back to the generic, which it all depends on, but it's more than owning a space that serves as a particular approach. Even inside a business, the train-the-trainer method is a part of this, learnable in a few days, and it's important to make the method ubiquitous. That's the way it scales.
So I actually gave some thought to this before we got started. And my experience with the imager way of knowing, this idea of watching a system at work, has the purpose of finding the local, specific, unique, distinctive, relevant, matchless, idiosyncratic, singular, kind of particular, never to scale or copy aspects kind of built into it. In imaging, it's really about working with the unique potential of each being and finding the nodal point that has the most effect on the health of the whole. So let me put it another way. Would you get the perfect child in your family and then scale that ideal to every other child? As a parent, say to yourself, let's make one and then make each the same. Another example of this is in school. We see this all the time with federal programs that tend to find something that works in one school or region and then standardize it and scale it across the whole U.S. And then we wonder why the whole thing fails massively.
Yeah. So clue number three, each epistemology has a history and you're giving us clues to where that comes from, but each one has its own history of how it got to where it is. In its expert way of knowing, there is an ordained or required source for knowing. The practices may be eclectic and mixing and matching, but they are drawn from a primary source that usually has a strong personality and a determining role of where it can go. I mean, experts like your idea, Zach, about hiring a few Einsteins you mentioned earlier. It does meet the expert way of knowing, which is thought to be the only way some can know or ordain to know. The references are important to know. They are the source of the expert approach, and often they are even a cult-like figure who's followed religiously, and they proclaim themselves being the expert. They are assumed to be the source of all knowledge. It tends to lead to rating and ranking of people by their degree of expertise, since the expert model needs a hierarchy. Their programs tend to have belts and certifications, so we know who's at the top, who to take direction from, who the top expert is. And people want the big name then to do the work. Don't send me your interns.
Yeah, it's true. The imagers use a shared paradigm as opposed to this kind of other way of thinking. The imagers use a shared paradigm and principles to co-create together. Carol, we follow a school of thought that has many people engaging rather than using consultants and trainers. Imagers tend to also be very independent in structuring how they work, where there are no top guns. There may be shifting project leaders, but are often small teams and small groups. By the way, Einstein is not the only one we know to have worked this way. We often describe great innovators and inventors like Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Madame Curie as thinking outside the box. If you read their biographies, you will see this image at work. It's not lateral thinking, which is suggested by some, which is really just more perspectives, which they're working with to mysteriously add all these ideas up without a clear path to get to some solution. It's more of a gestalt, where they're watching from the outside of the event and seeing the implicate process before they're actually explicit.
Yeah, so I'm finding it really helpful to finally have these into four clues. And this ability to be imaging, I think, is hopefully is becoming clearer to folks. Let's go ahead and look at the fourth clue, which I think of as where the instruments tools are. And primarily, you really will be able to see the difference here, although one of them will be very familiar and the other will be very unfamiliar. The instruments are significantly different in the expert, where the expert, you get models because you want to replicate it, right? You can't scale it unless you can replicate it. So you get models. There are times for models, which is like life and death situations, like if you're going to build an airplane. But even then, models do not protect against hubris, as we have learned recently here in the U.S. and around the world. You have to build critical thinking in order to do the imaging process. Now, maybe on takeoff, you want a set of step-by-step actions, a checklist, where nothing gets missed. But you better be able to image the process to get to that list and make sure pilots can see it so they understand why what they have there is there. Or otherwise, you fall back on the experts and then the people who are flying the plane don't know how to work with it.
Yeah, so I'll give you another example. So in our business, when we're designing for a game or film, we start by unfolding a deep understanding of the uniqueness of the world, the characters, the studio bringing it to life, the folks that are actually involved. Because if we started from an automatic, regular kind of consulting process, it would kill the aliveness we all experience from engaging in the project. And I can tell you unequivocally, we wouldn't have clients very long if we did that. And we'd be putting some pretty crappy games and products into the world.
Yeah, so you're talking about what you're doing is the imager capability. What you're talking about makes it possible for all people who are part of a team, a project, an organization to be able to develop good thinking about any subject by engaging with what the instrument is for the imager, which is frameworks. Now, frameworks give us the ability to order and organize our thinking. They work on how to think rather than what to think, which is what you get in the models. Here, think about this. There is one other big difference in the two epistemologies. Expertise is held by a few folks and shared with the others at different levels of approval. It's one of the ways to control knowledge, although it's not articulated often. This is one of the reasons for hierarchies. And it's also a justification for hierarchies. With imagers, you have frameworks that are there for creating understanding of each unique situation each time.
So just reflecting here for a minute, when I first met you, Carol, I was in graduate school. And one of the things that jumped out at me was you were offering two premises. First was, accept nothing I say without trying it out for yourself. The second was actually reject nothing without a deep experience and reflection and testing before you reject it. But that's really core to this epistemology. To be honest, it was the most confidence building and one of the most reasonable things I heard in graduate school. It's really because I was assumed to be intelligent enough to test the ideas, develop them on my own, and work on them. There were no expert authority needed and no tests to see if I got it right.
Yeah, the most important thing to make that work, by the way, and how it makes everyone smarter who learns to live in this way is to learn to engage using something called living systems frameworks. They have no answers built into them like a model does. The model has the answers and it gives you the answers. The framework gives you a place to ask questions, and there's no sequence, no steps to follow, no test to confirm a passing grade or to get a new belt or competency. They provide a way to find better questions that can lead to a group working together to find better answers. And every time they do this in the moment, in each unique situation, there are no generic answers to learn.
And it turns out that's what you use to get the answers we have today. You said you realized it was not just a list of clues, but four arenas, I think, as you were going through this. And you used a framework to order it. The first clue for folks is that you said it was a tetrad, which, listeners, looks like a diamond turned on its side. You asked what the ground, the starting place of maximum use for each of the methods. You had to genericize on expert and essence on the imager. Find the common denominator versus the unique differentiator. That's a big deal for a way to consult, or as Jennifer said, for a way to teach or parent.
Yeah, that's what I did. And frameworks can make it transparent for everyone, not just held by the few who know how the model was built. Plus, you can generate different kinds of questions, and each person can offer a question to keep evolving it. Or we can work on, you know, questions together and get to on the same page by doing that before we pursue the answers. What did you see as the next part of my tetrad?
The second was the goal. So you asked, what was the goal or outcome sought by each epistemology? For expert, it was find and show everyone how to achieve generically defined ideals, which makes, you know, a nice program, obviously, and then it makes it scalable to grow your business. But for the imager, it's to build capability of each and every person. So people are on their own ladder, not competing for a scramble to the top. That way, each person's personal potential is the goal. Then the third point in the framework, so I'll just keep going here, was who or what they take direction from. And that seemed to be the few limited talented ones who are bought and retained, as we talked about before. And the consultants who hold the knowledge of how to structure all these things, and sometimes are the self-proclaimed authorities. With the imagers, it's principles and paradigms shared across the community. It democratizes learning at the end of the day. I remember asking you when you first came to understand this, now that I think about it. You said it was Will Lynn, who was the president of Kingsford, said the difference between you and other consultants was the consultants left, and so did the skills and knowledge. And with you, you left a deeper and deeper capability in people, and the pervasiveness of the capability meant it wouldn't ever leave the organization. That created a shift in me, in my knowing my role, and maybe I should say my epistemology at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's a funny word, isn't it? But that's exactly what it means. You know, you can ask many questions when you've got a framework like you were just going through. And that's the beauty of a framework. It points to places to ask questions, not answers to be learned and implemented in turn. And how the arenas relate to each other. For example, I was asking the question, what did they use as the source of knowledge acquisition and learning? You framed it as where they got direction from. Both of those are legitimate questions on that framework. They're both useful and they're similar, but each one pushes your mind in a slightly different direction, which is really useful as situations change, you're able to be relevant.
Yeah. And so the fourth arena is all about instruments and tools and the implications of those. This is really about the direct comparison of a model specifying the answers compared to learning structured reflective thinking by everyone and using frameworks so that people can collaborate on creating the best questions and answers together.
And you know this, but that's what we do at Carol Sanford Institute. We have no answers for people to learn. We have no curriculum like the expert model, but we build critical thinking skills using frameworks and reflection and engage people in real time in applying and evolving them. And one more thing, The frameworks we're talking about in this epistemology, where the imaging is at work, are developed and held as a system based on how living systems work, not isolated, fragmented, here's one framework, here's another. They are embedded in what we call a living systems technology. That means the translation of science and philosophy into a working system you can use every day. Hopefully, that gives everyone an answer to Zach's question. Whoops, I just gave it away, Zach. You were the listener who wanted to know what I thought about that consulting group. How was that for an answer, and the puns intended there?
Yeah, that was actually really helpful, Carol. I now see the connection much more clearly between innovation and intelligence that we started with to kind of get things rolling. If anyone wants to see the framework that Carol and I were thinking through, check out the show notes for episode 128.
And when I work with young people in university schools and other settings, I always tell them not to trust me, like I told you, not to assume I know the answers. And I hope that it's giving people a way to their own examination. That's what these two sessions or episodes were about. When you talk to someone, find out what is their epistemology, what's the paradigm they use, what's the worldview they derived it from, and ask that is what you believe. You know, look at it, and is it what you want? And then design, whether it's with their practice or your practice. I avoid asking for experts and expert advice, and I avoid giving it. It's a very, very, very dangerous thing, a dangerous to good thinking. And smart businesses and smart humans work on this critical thinking skill. And by the way, it's more fun to share with you how I figured out how to evaluate them than to tell you my conclusions. I hope that is enough.
And thanks as always to Noumi T. Co-founders often get stuck, but Reem, one of the co-founders of Noumi, never stops asking hard questions to grow their business and its impact. Thank you, Noumi T, for continuing to be one of the courageous ones. Their tea is honestly amazing. My favorite is the gunpowder green. Also, our audience is growing, as is your involvement. Today's subject came from two listeners, which is pretty awesome. Tell a friend about Business Second Opinion, do a review where you listen, and send us ideas. We love being asked really hard questions that we have to figure out how to think about on the show. Also, don't forget, we're now on Spotify and in a bunch of new places. Check your podcast app that you use normally. And we love them so much, we actually concocted a new offer for you folks. Carol, do you want to tell them about what we've dreamt up here in the background?
Yeah, Zach and I were thinking that it'd be really nice to share something with you folks who are sending us these great questions and doing reviews. So we have an offer for you. We have created a beautiful 16-ounce mug, ceramic mug, colorful. We'll have it up on the website soon so you can look at it. And if you send us a question we're able to use to generate a show, or you do an in-depth review that shows people what you got out of a show and what you're doing with it, and send us a screenshot after it's posted so we know who it is. You can send all the notifications of that to carol@carolsanford.com. We want to send you a mug.
I'm pretty excited for these mugs, actually. We're short mugs in my house, so this is pretty awesome. So again, as always, don't forget to email us and tell us about your organization and practices. Again, the email is carol@businesssecondopinion.com. This has been Business Second Opinion.